Addison in motion to the right. Two receivers left. Rams blitz. Darnold gets away from it. Steps up in the pocket. He's holding it too long.
Just run.
Throw it, man.
Just run.
At the 25-yard line, he's sacked for a fifth time.
Now, back to
Will and Bibby
on 95.7 The Game.
That's Paul Allen, KFXN in Minnesota. He's been doing this for what feels like our whole lives. He is the very, very well-known voice of the Minnesota Vikings. And he had the same reaction that we did when we watched Sam Darnold play on Monday night. Dude, what are you doing?
He's holding it too long. It's so good.
Play that again. Hit that sucker again. Play that beautiful bean footage again, Mark Grandy.
Addison in motion to the right. Two receivers left. Rams blitz. Darnold gets away from it. Steps up in the pocket. He's holding it too long.
Just run.
Throw it, man.
Just run.
At the 25-yard line, he's sacked for a fifth time.
By the way.
Throw it, man.
He's holding it too long. Throw it, man!
Oh, it's so good.
And then he would go on to be sacked, I think, four more times after that.
He got sacked nine times?
Holy crap. Yeah, is that right? Nine? Nine!
Oh, boy.
By the Rams!
Yeah.
Not five, not six, not seven.
Wow, dude. It's hard to...
It was hard to watch.
Well, I get it. The offensive line was not good, and Dan Orlovsky's like, you're crazy if you think Sam Darnold was the main reason they lost. I'm not getting into that. I watched the football game. I watched Sam Darnold play, and I'm like, I don't understand what's happening. Like, yes, you're holding it way too long. And then, by the way, he got spooked. And we know that he has a propensity to do this.
Roast?
That guy dropped back when things were going poorly, but still had a chance to rally. And there was one play in particular, and I think it was Hockenson. He's going right over the middle, and Sam has time, and Sam must have thought that Hawk was going to sit down in the zone, and Hawk kept running. That's my only hope, because if not, Sam missed a 10-yard throw by 6 yards. Mm. He threw it so far behind him, and he was wide open, and I'm just like, I don't even know what the hell I'm watching anymore. So look, these guys all have bad games. I'm not here to cherry pick and suddenly tell you that Sam Darnold is not any good, but it's also hard not to ask everybody to stand up and be counted, because we heard a lot of this.
Yeah,
this reality now.
It looked like, to borrow from Guru, that he had a little case of lemon booty, and you know, when you see a guy open and you don't make the throw right away. Because you're thinking about it and you get locked up, and like you said, then he throws it and he thinks Hawk is going to stop and he doesn't. And I just looked at the numbers. 9 sacks for 82 yards.
Dude.
They lost 82 yards on sacks.
Yes.
That's, so he threw for 245, but his net yards were 163.
And every single one of those is a complete drive killer.
That's on me!
Drives over. Drives over. You just lost
like
9 yards. Yeah.
When you have your offensive line hold, the odds that you're going to convert, they go way down. Probably less than 10%.
It was December 17th that Bonte and Joe asked Baldy, hey, what are you going to do about this big, huge Brock Purdy extension?
I'd say I'd go flip him for Sam Darnold right now.
Wow.
I mean, why wouldn't I? So Minnesota, look, let's just think about Sam for a sec. He sat there as a backup all year. He learned what a first-class franchise game planning, how to build a team. Like, he saw that for the first time in his life. Now you've got Kevin O'Connell, who's an elite play caller with a very, very good offense that has a real style to it, and he's flourishing. Minnesota doesn't have to commit anything to him right now. All they're doing, I talked to the general manager 2 weeks ago, Quezzy. You can play it out. They've got a quarterback they drafted. They don't have to give him top flight money, or they could trade him. Like, I would be having a conversation with Minnesota to see what it would take to get Sam Darnold back. He's a bigger, stronger, more athletic, I don't know, but he's bigger, stronger than what Brock is. Or can you play with both of them at a modicum of salary and afford both and, I don't know, have a competition?
Okay, so I remember this comment.
Yep.
We talked about it the next day. It never did add up. Even if you wanted to go get Sam Darnold at what feels like a discounted rate based on the idea of Brock getting a massive extension, I hope, and I'm not going to pretend like everybody listening to us now was listening 20 minutes ago, but throwing out what would likely be the structure of a contract for Brock Purdy, in short, next year would mean $15 million. That would be your cap hit next year. You're not getting Sam for that.
Probably not.
So in other words, it's not like a lot of people go, why take Sam? Because I got him for a lot less. No, it probably costs twice as much, actually, as Brock Purdy. So you have to really, really like Sam Darnold. I mean, you have to be so in love with Sam Darnold if you wanted to do that. Now, Baldy, yesterday, so would you still flip Brock Purdy for Sam Darnold?
The only reason why I said that a couple weeks ago, Bonte, was we were talking about, do you want to give Brock Purdy $60 million or top five money, or is there another option? And at the time, Sam Darnold was 14-2 or 13-2. He was throwing 35 touchdown passes. He looked like a good option at that point. Now, he's been terrible these last two games, no question. Like, off. And if you just spaced everything off two games, you wouldn't even have a phone call. But he's had five clunkers this year, five that looked like the last few weeks. But he's also won 14 games. They do have a 14-4 record. Now, you can say, all right, they beat up on the Bears, whoever. But he did throw 35 touchdown passes this year, and they did win 14 games. So I get all the fans that want to blast me. I understand. I'm fine.
Okay.
He's fine.
Yes. I'm not worried about Baldy. But I disagreed with the notion then, and I disagree with the notion now.
Yeah, and I don't know just how much Sam will get now, and I also don't know if Minnesota will franchise him. If they do, it's $43 million. That's the estimated number that he'll get for just 1 year. And this year, there weren't that many guys making that kind of money. And I also was looking at J.J. McCarthy's rehab from the torn meniscus. As we know from talking to Dr. Nirav Pandya, when you repair a meniscus, it's a six-month rehab. And that's the operation he had. And I know he had some swelling along the way, a little bit of a setback. So he should be ready to go by March and ready to go for camp next year. But do you want to turn over a team that was really good this year to a guy who will essentially be a rookie? Do you bring back Darnold? But when you have a team like the Niners that has a quarterback that they know they can win with, you don't flirt or get tempted by anything else that might be out there, whether it's, hey, maybe Kirk Cousins gets cut and we can get him in on the cheap, or maybe we can get Darnold in for less now that he flamed out a little bit. You go with what you have and what you know.
Well, and again, I think there's a way. This is what's most important. There's a way to make Brock Purdy a crazy rich man. And also, for the next three full 49ers seasons, you're not paying him an amount that's going to crush your cap or prevent you from having other players. I was a little surprised by this, and I assume it was Lucas. Lucas, did you send this tweet out on the 95.7 Game account? Where he wrote 5 years, $305 million, $61 million per year. That's David Lombardi's projection for Brock Purdy's extension. Now, and I get this, there's no room on Twitter for all of the little intricacies of it, just simply $61 million per year. And I think if you stick that out in a place like Twitter, I thought people were going to huck tomatoes at his head. But listen to the responses. Get it done. In reality, it would be $145 for 3 years. Nate says 45 or 50 a year would be better. Steel Age Savage says he's earned it. Jamie says it's the market, but too much if he doesn't want to keep and get players to another Super Bowl. Now there's hard pass, holy overpay, but then there's sounds good. Mike Maxwell, not my money, good for Brock. I would just say there's more positivity in here than I would have predicted.
Yeah, and it's early in the process, but if you are somebody who doesn't like Brock Purdy, or you don't think that, you know, he should be the quarterback, then you can have that thought. But if you really want to keep Brock, you have to understand what the market forces are in the National Football League. And when you're the next quarterback up, you usually have a chance to reset the market, especially when you've accomplished what Brock has, which is 4 playoff wins in 3 seasons, 2.5 as a starter, and a team that has the room to pay a guy a lot of money. And I do like the one commenter about it really is 145 for 3,
yeah.
And it's what we talked about, how after 3 years, you can get out of it or rework it. And so even if you look at it from that standpoint, $47 million a year, that still isn't a gross overpay.
Now, we're excited because Greg Cosell is going to join us in a few minutes. We're excited for multiple reasons. First of all, we're going to dive into the NFL playoffs all around the board. We're going to dive into the Sam Darnold situation, the Brock Purdy situation, plus Dibs might get schooled. You just don't know. You just don't know. That's what happens when Greg Cosell of NFL Films comes on, and he's going to do that next. We're sponsored by Crystal Geyser Alpine Springwater. Also want to tell everybody a little bit more about our knockout tournament, which is back. Your chance to play ball on the Chase Center floor. How cool is that? We start Monday, January 27th and go for 3 weeks. And for those 15 weekdays, you will have 3 chances to qualify each day. 1 per show, 8 a.m. hour, noon hour, 4 p.m. hour, starting Monday, January 27th. So join us for that. Very easy to qualify. Hopefully you'll have some luck and get in and play hoops with us on the Chase Center floor. You have to be at least 18 years old. You have to be a California resident. More details are on the way. Just like Greg Cosell is on Willard and Dibs.
Now, back to Willard and Dibs.
That's a great question.
It's a great question.
That's a great question.
On 95.7 The Game.
We plan on asking even more, and we plan on doing it shortly, because Dibs?
Yeah?
It's that time.
What time?
It's that time.
Not the that time?
Your favorite time.
It is my favorite time. It's when I get nervous.
Do you?
The butterflies come out.
We mentioned this once before. On the River Islands guest line, it's the executive producer of NFL Films and our weekly friend and one of our favorites, Greg Cosell. Do you know that, Greg, that you make Dibs nervous?
Well, now I do.
Yeah.
Now that you've mentioned it.
Yeah.
All you have to do is look at the tape from these interviews, and you can see. thank you, Greg. I thought you'd like that. It's pretty.
I'm not nervous. I'm just going to make it up as we go.
Okay, great. That's what I do every day. Let's rock. You know what? This is not where I was going to start, but I just saw it, and I wanted to run it by you and see what you thought. This is a quote that The Athletic just put out from an unnamed Super Bowl-winning executive. Okay, an unnamed Super Bowl winning executive talking about Kyle Shanahan, who has taken his fair share of criticism this year after a 6-11 season. He said, quote, "Within the coaches in the league, no one thinks any less of Kyle Shanahan. It's ludicrous to think they should get rid of him. Andy Reid had the same criticisms early in his career, and now he's clearly in the conversation for best ever. Kyle Shanahan's criticisms are that he's lost a couple of Super Bowls. Do you know how hard it is to get to the Super Bowl? If you throw rocks at Kyle Shanahan and want him fired, he's going to have a job in 30 seconds. What's your reaction to that quote?
I agree 1,000%. I don't see, to me, that's not even a question. Like, I don't even think that would be, and based on the specific nature of that quote, I'm sure you were reading it word for word, correct?
Yep, word for word.
Basically, if you just take the tone of the quote, the guy's saying that anybody who thinks otherwise really knows nothing about football. That's the tone of the quote. And I would agree with that 1,000%.
When you look at what we saw from the tape this year, forget Kyle Shanahan for just a moment, but defensively, now that they're looking for a new coordinator, is it a scheme thing that you saw on tape, or was it more just execution defensively that allowed them to struggle at times, especially in fourth quarters?
Well, I would answer that, and I may have discussed that when you were not on, you know, toward the end of the year for those 2 weeks. I think that becomes a philosophy thing, and there's no right answer other than if you don't believe something is working, you might want to make a change. Because clearly this year, they chose to be a team that hardly ever pressured quarterbacks. They were a very low percentage blitz team. Now, again, we've seen in the past Fred Warner be a really, really good blitzer, adding in as the fifth pass rusher. We've seen that. I remember doing pieces for years in the matchup show where we showed five-man pressures, and Warner was part of the pressures, and they were successful. This year, they were a very low percentage pressure team by NFL standards. So they relied pretty much exclusively on their four-man D-line pass rush, and they relied on coverage with seven in coverage. You can make the argument that, hey, that didn't work as well as they had hoped. I'm sure that's one reason that Sorensen is no longer the D coordinator. So now it comes down to philosophy, because you can be good any number of ways. You just have to decide what you think is the best way to play with your personnel, and they obviously believe that what happened this year didn't quite work out the way they hoped, that there's going to be a change.
Greg, I think a lot of people have been, I know I have been, looking forward to talking to you after round one of the playoffs and three specific quarterback performances that people thought were below par to ask what you saw. Let's start with Justin Herbert. And I know that at least one, probably two, maybe even three of the interceptions weren't really on him, or maybe I'm wrong. What did you see with his performance, and was it out of character?
Well, and I would say that, number one, their O-line got manhandled in the game, and he was under significant duress throughout the game. Number two, which probably should be number one, they couldn't run the ball at all, and they're a team with Greg Roman as the OC, and you guys are familiar with Greg Roman because he was there with Harbaugh. I think he was the OC when they went to the Super Bowl, if I'm not mistaken, back in the one in New Orleans, I believe, where the game was paused due to the whatever, you remember that.
Yeah, the Harbaugh Bowl.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, the point is they're a run-first football team in the way they play offense, and you know that in any number of ways, not only by their run-pass ratio, but by the fact that they use a converted D-end as a fullback, so they couldn't run the ball at all. So their whole offensive identity changed pretty quickly in that game, and their O-line was overmatched, which probably surprised many, because they have the left tackle Slater, who's a good player, the rookie right tackle Alto had a solid year, but both those guys struggled all game, as did the interior of their O-line. So Herbert was under duress much of the game. So yes, did he play his best game? No. You know, it's funny, you guys didn't do this, but obviously, you know, I'm aware of what people say. You know, I don't spend a ton of time listening to everybody, but I love the way people evaluate quarterbacks based on these games, as if, you know what, let's just get rid of him and move on and get someone else. I mean, it's just ridiculous. As if they think there's a quarterback store and you just go get another quarterback.
Well, sure. No, and Herbert and Jordan Love, I mean, look, they're signed up. They've had good years. They're talented. There is an interesting conversation, I think, around Sam Darnold. Not because he didn't have a good year suddenly. He did. But because we know who he was prior to this year, because he's a free agent and not signed up, that one maybe is a little bit different, in my opinion. What do you think of what you saw him do on Monday night?
Here's what I would say. I would say in the Lions game 2 weeks ago that he missed far too many throws that we've seen him make all year. He just missed them, okay? But I would say in this game, this past week, he had no chance. He was under ridiculous duress the entire game. I spoke last week on a number of things I did that I thought that the key matchup in that game was going to be the Rams' defensive front versus the Vikings' O-line, which is not very good in pass protection. And I thought that was going to be the deciding factor in the game, and it was. So this game, to me, was not on Sam Darnold. You know, obviously he threw a pick that was, and by the way, his arm was hit. He couldn't follow through on that, so that wasn't even his fault. But so I didn't view this game watching the tape as, oh my God, boy, Sam Darnold was bad. The week before, he missed a number of throws. This game, they were just so significantly overmatched up front that I think there's probably four quarterbacks in the league that could have played really well in this game, and we know which four those are. So, yeah, so this wasn't, to me, a Sam Darnold game, but you know, that's the perception, and that's what I'm hearing all week. Oh, well, this is Sam Darnold's back being Sam Darnold, you know, and those kinds of comments to me just, when you say something like that, and I hope you guys aren't the ones who are saying that, because to me, when I hear that, I just think, you know, these guys, they just don't know football, and they're just saying stuff. It's like the guys who make these bold declarations Monday morning at 8 a.m. on the East Coast, of course, you know, and as all they've done is watch the game on TV. You know, you can't tell watching the game on TV what really happened.
Yeah, you got to watch the film, Greg, like you and I, and, you know, get really deep into the All-22. Taking that thought forward with the Ram defensive line, and Mark and I were talking before the show about how good this Ram defense has been over the last month. What do you see on tape from the Rams defense that can maybe not stop Saquon and Jalen in Philadelphia, but maybe slow them a little bit and make it uncomfortable?
Yeah, now this is a little different animal, okay, because the Eagles have a great D-line, and the strength of the and the strength of the Rams D-line is really their pass rush, okay? It's young, it's Verse. Verse may be the best speed-to-power rusher in the league as a rookie, and then they have Fisk and Turner inside. That's their sort of NASCAR pass rush D-line. That's not the D-line that plays when they're in their base defense. Then they try to put bigger people in who can stop the run. Because both Fisk and Turner are probably under 300 or right around 300. They're not big guys relative to normal D tackles in the league. So this particular matchup is a totally different animal than the one from last week. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the Eagles do, how they choose to run the ball. Do they choose to run the ball with two tight ends and see if the Rams play their base D, or will they choose to run the ball out of 11 personnel, meaning three wide receivers on the field, and maybe they get the Rams pass rush unit on the field, but it's a lighter group and not as strong against the run. So, yeah, this game is nothing like, matchup-wise, like the Rams' D-line against the Vikings' O-line.
Greg Cosell, NFL Films, with us every single week throughout the season on Willard and Dibbs. Greg, I was with you last week. I am a big fan of the Broncos' defense, and I was surprised at how easily or how well the Bills controlled the line of scrimmage in that football game, and it has me pretty high on the Bills going forward. But what was your take on the way that one played out, and what does it mean for the Bills going forward?
Yeah, that was a surprise, I think, because I think that the D-line for the Broncos had played well all year. Their defense had played well all year. But the Bills clearly felt, based on their film study, that they could come out and run the ball. They could line up with six O-line personnel, which they've done more than any team in the league by a wide, wide margin. And they did that in this game, and they ran on first down. You know, Cook had 13 for 78 in the first half. Nine of those 13 runs came on first down. So their game plan was clearly to run the ball, whether the Broncos were in their base defense or their nickel defense. They played 10 snaps with six O-linemen in the first half. Eight of those were runs. They clearly believed in their game planning, film study, everything that goes into that process, that they could line up and physically beat that Broncos defensive front, and they did. And I think that surprised a lot of people. Now, having said that, looking forward, that Ravens defensive front is big. That is one of the biggest defensive fronts in the league, and it's tough to move them. So I'm going to be very intrigued to see if the Bills take the same approach. The other factor in this game is they were playing a Broncos offense that they probably felt was not going to put up 30 points. So they probably felt that they could be patient. They could play the kind of game that they did and just kind of gradually pull away and win fairly handily. But it took the second half for that to happen. Will they feel... what kind of game will they feel this one will be? In other words, will they feel that they have to score more points early and make it more of a Josh Allen game? And I think that's one of the most intriguing elements of this game.
And how does the Buffalo run defense stack up against the number one rush offense in football in the Baltimore Ravens?
Well, that's going to be a tough deal. That's a really they're a really difficult offense to play against. The run game is really hard because of both Lamar and Derrick Henry. The pass game, Lamar has been phenomenal this year. So they're a really hard offense to play against. I think that the Bills secondary, you know, is probably not a great secondary overall. Now, Sean McDermott's been doing this a long time, and someone who's a lot smarter than I am, Bill Belichick, I heard him talk about Sean McDermott and how he does little things, little wrinkles that can be difficult for offenses to, you know, things that, unless you really know, he knows more than I do, obviously, you know, so you know, I think that stuff's going to have to happen in this game for them to have a chance. And their D-line is going to have to play great. Their D-line is going to have to really play at a super high level, because that run game, it's hard in multiple ways. It's hard physically, and it's also hard schematically.
I'm also interested, well, both of the other games, quite frankly. I mean, Kansas City, we've talked so much about how there's the people we all know in Mahomes and Kelsey, but that team also has one of the best defenses.
They sure do.
Right in the NFL, and now rested and home and all of these things. Like, what did Houston do in their somewhat surprising game against the Chargers that would carry over, if anything?
Well, you know, Houston's an interesting situation. They've got a really, really good defense. They've got two phenomenal edge players in Anderson and Hunter. They've got two really good corners, Stingley and Lassiter. The Lassiter has been phenomenal as a rookie. You know, so their defense is really good. And they've got more players than that, too, but they're the ones people know about. But yet, offensively, I think, look, I don't think this game's going to be 35-30, but I think that they're going to have to score some. And, you know, Stroud's been up and down this year. I thought he made a couple of really good throws last week, but for the most part, he's working through his development. See, this is the other thing I find interesting. When people talk about these guys, you know, it takes time. He had the great rookie year, so all of a sudden everybody assumed he's on his way to the Hall of Fame. You know, this year, you know, a couple of things started to stand out. He struggled a bit in the pocket when there were people around him. You saw last week that the offensive staff, they really built a beautiful game plan. Everything was quick rhythm. Get the ball out, because that's who he is. At his core, he's a pocket quarterback who needs to play with timing and rhythm. But, you know, Steve Spagnuolo, there's not a better situational defensive play caller in the league, especially with pressure, than Spags. And that's going to be a really intriguing part of this game.
How does Kansas City look to you when you look at the film offensively? Because I see a passing attack that is really middle of the pack,
yep,
and a run game that is almost bottom five in football.
Yeah, they've become a team that's really not great on offense throughout four quarters, but in those critical, what we call high leverage situations, Mahomes seems to make a play. So they haven't necessarily scored a ton of points this year, but in, like I said, in those critical moments, they convert. I mean, keep one thing in mind. They are the best third down offense in the NFL. A lot of people might not know that, but they convert on third down. And that's absolutely critical. And they've really turned into, I don't want to say turned into, but Mahomes has, I think, the second most dropbacks of any quarterback in the league. And that might surprise people, because this year, people aren't looking at the Chiefs going, man, that offense is just explosive. But yet they're a passing offense, even though they're not necessarily hitting 50, 60-yard plays. So, you know, they're kind of an interesting team. And keep in mind, you know, someone like Kelsey, who, you know, a lot of people said didn't have a great year and he didn't numbers-wise, he's going to have 25 days off. I mean, you know, these guys are going to be rested and ready to go. They're going to be healthy.
Speaking of rested and ready to go and maybe getting a little healthier, I love the Detroit Lions offense, especially indoors, and it sounds like they're going to get David Montgomery back.
Yeah.
How does that change what they do? And going against a young Washington team, what do you see as kind of the pressure points in that game?
Yeah, I don't think it changes much of what they do, other than the fact that Gibbs probably won't get 21 carries a game like he's gotten the last three games. And boy, is that guy explosive. But just to show you how good, you know, their O-line is, just like the Eagles' O-line, like Saquon Barkley leads the NFL in the fact that he's almost 75% of his yards have come, you know, before contact. You know, same with Gibbs. He's in the 70% range, you know, so that's remarkable. Those, you know, the Lions have a great O-line. And Goff, you know, he's a pocket quarterback, but they protect him, and he may throw the ball between the numbers. He's a window thrower, as good a window thrower as there is in the league. So that's going to be an interesting matchup against that secondary. Obviously, Marshawn Lattimore is now back playing. He's still a quality corner. But their offense is difficult, because they can beat you so many different ways with a really good O-line and just good skill people.
I'm not asking you to put yourself in the minds of the voter or pretend you are a voter, but just watching the film this year, who do you think was the best offensive player that you saw on tape?
Oh, boy. That's one of those questions. The best offensive player.
Because you watched all the tape, and you know everyone wants to talk about who's the MVP. But I wanted to go to a film guy, Greg, a guy who actually sees it like I see it from an All-22 standpoint. And,
oh, boy.
And just see what you thought when you're looking at the tape. Who stands out as the most effective offensive player?
Boy, there's a lot of players in the league. I mean, I'm trying to, trying to look at the teams right now. You know, as the best. You know, again, we're not necessarily talking about most valuable. We're not necessarily talking about that. The best offensive player. You know, I'll tell you, the guy that comes to my mind, and you know, obviously he's a great player. So it's not. This might not be profound. But the guy that comes to my mind is Joe Burrow, and I'll tell you why. Because keep this in mind. When you go into a game every Sunday knowing that you have to put up 35 points just to have a chance to win, it's not even guaranteed that if you put up 35, you're going to win, but just to have a chance to win, I'm not sure people understand how hard that is. So given what he did this year under those circumstances, I would say that his name would just came to my mind. Again, you know, you're asking me a question that I don't have, you know, an hour to think about.
Yeah,
but that just came to my mind.
I like the answer.
Greg, are you an MVP voter?
I am not.
You're not. Yeah. Okay.
I'm not allowed to do any of that because I work for the league.
Got it.
There you go.
Got it. Okay.
So yeah, I can't be a Hall of Fame voter, although guys who vote for the Hall of Fame reach out to me to ask me my opinion, but I'm not allowed to be a Hall of Fame voter.
Okay. So you wouldn't even weigh in on Lamar Jackson versus Josh Allen on the MVP race.
And be honest with you guys, and I know fans might not like my answer, I don't care about that kind of stuff at all. Yeah, that's meaningless to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
Not surprised.
Yeah. That's why I asked it the way I asked it, because I didn't want you to get into the popularity contest aspect of it, but I like the answer with Joe Burrow.
Just like I don't like when people, like I heard someone talking, you know, because I'm on, you know, I see social media, obviously I don't sit there all day and look at it, but I mean, I hear some stuff, and I hear people, you know, saying things like, well, you know, if Josh Allen loses this game, you know, that's going to prove that he's really not that good, or, you know, if Lamar loses this game, well, then people are going to say he can't win. You know, I mean, you know, so, okay, so what does that, you know, what does that mean? So does that mean the Bills should get rid of Josh Allen?
Yeah.
Or Ravens should get rid of Lamar Jackson?
Greg,
I mean, they say this stuff, and what does it even mean?
Greg, I'm moving on from the loser of this game.
No doubt.
I'm moving on.
Yep.
I'm out.
Yeah, I think they should just go to that quarterback store that I mentioned earlier and just, you know, get another quarterback.
Yeah, yeah. Sam Darnold, free agent.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, there it is. Greg Cosell says, pick up Sam Darnold and cut Josh Allen.
There you go, right, exactly.
All
right,
perfect. Yeah. Greg, thanks, man. Great to talk to you as always.
Guys, I love it. Thanks so much.
All right, there he goes. Greg Cosell, NFL Films. With a little whirl around on the league there.
I liked it, yeah.
That was good.
A little primer for the best weekend in football, the divisional round where you get the two best teams rested against some upstarts. Four good games coming our way.
Yeah, you think this is the best?
I do, yeah.
All year.
Yeah, because a lot of times in the wild card round, you either get a lame 8-9 division winner or a weak wild card team. You get blowouts in that round. I think you get more blowouts then than you do this weekend.
Probably, because, you're looking at seasoned, obviously, playoff winners now.
I mean, Buffalo and Baltimore, are you kidding me?
Oh, come on. Well, and to your point, I would argue, I guess, of the six games last weekend, wouldn't you say, like, as far as what rated high on the watchability scale, probably only one of them.
Yeah.
That Bucks-Commanders game is probably the only one where you're like, man, that was a great game. That was really fun watch.
Well, watchability, the Houston-Charger game was really watchable because there was crazy S that was happening all over the place.
Sure, but it was a 3-touchdown victory.
By the end of it, yeah. But there was... there was a 2-point conversion return. There was multiple picks. Yeah. There were fumbles. There was some zany stuff that was happening.
There was a lot going on.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very chargery.
It was
totally chargery football game. But yeah, the only game that wasn't a double-digit victory was the Commanders over the Bucks, and you got a doink to end it.
Right.
I always love a game that ends on a doink. All right, we're brought to you by Fremont Bank. Here for you, here for good. You know who's here right now? Or at least about to be? Yeah.
Cousin Nick
Friedel. You want an NBA conversation? Because we're about to go in on an NBA conversation. He's in the know. He's the best. Nick Friedell in studio for a full hour. Coming up next on Willard and Dibs.
Now, back to Willard and Dibs.
I mean, Mark, it's so good to hear y'all's voices. And Mr. Dibs, I mean, it's just been way too damn long. So it puts a smile on my face.
On 95.7 The Game.
I give up. I don't want the role anymore.
Of what?
It's too much pressure. I've had it. I can't do it anymore, Dibs.
Oh, so I know where you're going.
I'm turning in my wings.
No more carrying the burden of being the deep voice guy?
I cannot be the deepest voice on this station anymore. It's too much pressure.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
So we go to the River Islands guest line, which is not a guest line because he's sitting here next to us. It is Odyssey Sports NBA insider, cousin Nick Friedell, who is in the damn room. Hi, Nick.
It is so good to see you guys.
Cousin Nick, my guy Nick Friedell.
Mr. Dibs, Mark. Hilariously, the whole reason I'm sitting here right now, I'm headed to a birthday party in L.A. this week.
Oh, okay.
But I'm sitting here right now because I get my rental car, which I haven't had since I last was out here a few years ago, and I turn on the station, and you guys are talking to Kerr yesterday.
Steve Kerr, sure.
And I call the listener line. I am calling into the studio because I wanted to come on and say, hey, you guys did a great job with that interview.
Well, thank you.
And we'll get into all that Kerr said and the layers there. But I'm sitting there thinking, oh, man, I'm going to talk to my guys. And I call in, and so many people must have been trying to get in that nobody even picked me up. And I went, uh-oh.
Yeah.
it's either that the lines were full.
The lines had to be full on that one.
Or it was that Lucas was asleep.
I'd love to cancel Lucas. Yeah. I'd love to. But I know how good that was because I was sitting there listening to it, and I know what you guys asked him and what he said and what he meant in what he was saying. But that cracked me up because then instantly I'm texting Lucas, like, tell the guys they did great. And he's like, where are you? And
exactly.
I'm in a rental car in Alameda right now.
Hope you learned your lesson. If you call us, you're going to end up being here the next day.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. No, but it is great to see y'all.
It's great to see you. And thank you for being here. And Insider Calls are brought to you by Hyundai. Now you can buy a new Hyundai at Amazon. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. We get to hang out with Cousin Nick for a while. What'd you think? So you listened to Steve Kerr. What stood out?
Mark, he told you exactly what's going on.
Yep.
And anybody who has listened to Steve through the years, and there are so many diehard Warriors fans out there that listen to the station, Steve Kerr could not have been any clearer in the messaging he was trying to get across. Hey, everybody, we are going to try as hard as we possibly can to win games and not waste the end of Steph's prime and everything you guys discuss all the time. But my biggest takeaway, Mark, is Steve was honest about exactly where they're at. And when he said we're a fading team, that is 100% the truth. And as far as I'm concerned, it was an adjustment in the expectations, not only moving forward into this year, but moving ahead. And what I am curious about, and I know there are so many clips that I heard Goo and Steiny replaying it. I'm sure Bonte and Chasky did too. But the clip where he's saying, you know, I'd love to ask Danny Ainge, would he really move Larry Bird and all those guys at the end of that Celtics dynasty? What I'm curious about moving forward now, not only this year but the next couple of years, is what happens when Steph and Draymond stay right around 500? Because I know Mike Dunleavy, he played for the Bulls when I was covering him. I saw him obviously here when he took that job. I know how badly he wants to win and keep this whole thing moving. But if this team is 500 a year from right now, at what point, as badly as he wants to stay here and be in one jersey his whole career, because he's told me, he's told you guys the same thing over and over, does Steph go, this is just killing me? Because those are some of the most competitive guys I've ever met doing this job. There are a lot of different things to pull out of what you guys had the conversation about, but It's why I, in the role of journalist writer, have always appreciated just how honest Kerr is.
Yeah.
Because he was telling everybody, hey, here's the situation that we're in. It's not going to change anytime soon, at least dramatically. I know you guys mentioned Vucevic. There's been the talk about Jimmy. None of those guys is going to fix the problem here. And the problem for the Warriors, aside from Steph and Draymond and some nights Wiggins, there's just not enough talent on this team to think that they can get back to championship level.
Yeah, no doubt. Nick Friedell here in studio, 95.7 The Game, and that's kind of what I was saying all along. But to hear not only Steve Kerr, but to also hear, you know, Steph and Draymond with a certain amount of a tone shift, where they're all now kind of, you know, echoing the same party line, which is, we don't want to mortgage the future, and we don't want to, you know, sacrifice assets and all these other things. I get the last 72 hours where it feels like the tone has shifted among not only Steve Kerr, and you're right, Nick, he's always been so frank and honest with his assessments, but now we get into a spot where it's Steph and Draymond in their own ways saying similar things. So I just wonder what happens over the next 3 weeks, the deadline 3 weeks from tomorrow. And yesterday was a little bit of a shock to hear him say it the way he did.
And Dibs, as you guys know, it's been repeated. I mean, Kerr has talked to you guys. I saw he talked to Slater. Draymond was talking the other night. Steph has said as much a couple different times. Those guys see the reality. And the reality is, this is not a title contender. As badly as they want it to be, as well as Steph is still playing night to night, they are just not good enough to where they were. And I think that is the biggest change from the conversations the last few years. I mean, Warriors fans are so unbelievably loyal, but they've been so spoiled, guys. And this is just the reality of the basketball business. I was listening to BJ Armstrong earlier with Steiny and Goo, and he said,
great guest.
He said as much. He said, look, ask Bulls fans. Yep. Ask anybody who has been through that run. Ask the Lakers fans with Shaq and Kobe. You know when it's just about over, and when it hits, it's always ugly. And to me, the takeaway isn't, all right, Steph and Draymond and Steve Kerr, they're still going to fight till the very end. The takeaway is, what happens a couple years from now? Because Steph so badly wanted to stay in one place and be with one team, and now he's to a point where you go, as much as he wants that, is there going to come a point as the losing piles up, or I should say the not winning at the clip we're right. used to, does that point come where he goes, I'd like to try one more time to win something else?
So you mentioned that there's no, like, quote-unquote deal that's going to immediately fix this. But before we go into any specific names and players, I wonder how you'd answer this. Is there any value to the Warriors still making some sort of a deal here over the next 2-3 weeks?
I don't think so in this sense, Mark, only because I don't think there's a guy that makes that much of a difference. Vucevic is a perfect name. The Bulls would love to move off him, give him a couple second-round picks and something, sure. Does he make you better? Yeah. But Vucevic is who he is at this point in his career. He's going to get you 20. He might have 10 rebounds, and he's going to give up a whole ton on the defensive end. So is there a move that could make them a little bit better? Sure. Is there any move if you have to risk, and we all know what the assets are at this point, picks, Kuminga, and something else, that gets them to a different level? I don't see that out there.
Yeah, and that to me becomes a more logical approach, where you do make a move, whether it's Vucevic or Cam Johnson. You get a little bit better now, and then you hope in the offseason you can get significantly better. And I wonder what you think about the asset that is Jonathan Kuminga, because I'm fascinated by this one part of it, because in the offseason he reportedly wanted a max, which is 50 or so million, and it was a non-starter. And, you know, the team probably wanted him to go out and prove it. He started to prove it, then he got hurt. So what do you think of the asset that is Jonathan Kuminga? Because he's an emerging player, but if you do have him go to restricted free agency and another team offers him $40 million a year, do the Warriors want to give him $40 million a year, or do you end up getting nothing for Jonathan Kuminga after 4 years of some nurturing?
Dibs, the short answer for me is...
I'll take your time.
I would move him. I would move him. But if you're the Warriors and you've invested this time into developing Jonathan Kuminga and you're seeing the flashes, and we've seen it so often, hey, he can be a really solid player. But this is what always happens in the NBA. The next contract hits, and with it, the expectations change. And the second that those change, you go, do I really want to pay this dude $40, $50 for the production that is there now? I'll give you a perfect example. We're mentioning the Bulls and Vucevic. Zach LaVine. He's a really nice offensive player. But when you give Zach LaVine max money, there's a reason the Bulls can't move him. Because everybody looks at that contract and they go, I don't want any part of that. Like people say, would LaVine fit on the Warriors? Of course he would fit. And he'd actually fit really well because what is the problem right now? They can't really score aside from Steph. They cannot find any consistent rhythm there. But do I want Zach LaVine on that contract on my team? Hell no. So with Kuminga, the question to me, guys, and you're watching it a lot closer than I am now day to day, but do you see him being able to develop to a point where he's getting you 20, 25 every single night and he is that dominant force that max players have to be? I personally don't see that. I would move him before I have to make that decision, to your point, Mr. Dibs. But if you're the Warriors and you've invested all the time and development into seeing what he's becoming and will continue to become wherever he goes, or if he stays here, that would be a really tough pill to swallow to not then match the restricted offer sheet that we figure will come
his
way.
Well, that's the pickle. I mean, the idea of moving him now, I've thought for a while, is like a non-starter because of how much he makes. Like, he's only making $7 million.
Right.
Why am I going to send him out now to get $7 million in return? It's almost like Jonathan, from a financial standpoint, if there's a deal for the Warriors right now, he's a throw-in.
Yeah.
And he's actually the linchpin of the deal.
Absolutely. Of any deal. It's a scary if you're Mike Dunleavy, Mark, what I would say is he came into the job with his eyes wide open. So none of this this whole dynasty, it's coming to a close. Mike's a really smart guy. He knew what he was walking into, but these are the decisions. What do you do with Kuminga? How much do you worry about the deal that's coming? It's not a question that anybody really wants to face because there are so many corresponding moves that come after it.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco and Odyssey Sports Station, always live on the free Odyssey app, Twitch, and YouTube, powered by First NorCal Credit Union. For a low-rate auto loan, apply online or just ask for First NorCal Financing at the dealer.